Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Mandy Johnston, and as always, we're here to make sense of the world by looking at the stories behind the headlines this week. Coming up on today's show, coalition government and the programme for government talks are officially underway here, and all eyes are on the horse trading, backroom deals and political machinations that come with it. To help us unravel the drama, we're going to be joined by two seasoned insiders, former Labour Party leader Pat Rabbit and journalist and author Stephen Collins. They've both seen and experienced the highs and lows of coalition building, and they'll be sharing their insights into the current round of talks, plus a bit of skullduggery about what goes on behind the scenes. And in a move that has sent shockwaves through the footballing world, Saudi Arabia has officially been announced as the host of the 2034 FIFA World Cup. Following in the footsteps of Qatar's historic 2022 tournament, this decision marks another seismic shift in the sport's history, firmly planting the Middle East as a dominant player in global football. Martin Lipton is one of football's most insightful commentators, and he's going to join me later to delve into the implications of this yet again historic decision. And finally, as Justin Trudeau steps down as Canadian Prime Minister, we'll take a closer look at his legacy. Has he lived up to the promise of a young progressive leader, or has Canada been left precariously placed on the global stage? You can contact us via email on takingstock@newstalk.com or on X at StockNT. Now, FIFA's decision in early January to award the 2034 World Cup to Saudi Arabia was met with uproar from predictable corners of the world. But now those within Saudi Arabia are expressing some reservations about the feasibility of this planned audacious spectacle. How did they actually secure the competition? And can a struggling Saudi construction sector cope with it? And what might the World Cup in 2034 look like? Well, joining me to answer some of those questions is Martin Lipton, Chief Sports Reporter at The Sun. Martin, you're very welcome back to News Talk.
My pleasure.
Martin, maybe we just go back a little bit and take us back to the announcement in December, because I think a lot of people actually missed it. The announcement, the physical announcement itself, was a bit of a disaster, but maybe talk to us a little bit about the process around it and the initial reaction to how Saudi secured the tournament itself.
This has been coming for about 18 months. It's pretty clear from fairly early on that the Saudis wanted to win a World Cup. And under the rules, because the 2022 World Cup was in Qatar, they couldn't bid for a World Cup for some time because of the rotation rules. So the way around it was basically to tweak the rules. It was supposed to be South America's turn in 2030. Everyone thought that it would be the centenary World Cup, the first World Cup had been in 1930 in Uruguay. But also Europe was saying, come on, we're the power base of world football. We have to have a World Cup. We can't wait till 2034. So Gianni Infantino, the smartest man in world football, without a question, whether you like him or not, the president of FIFA, devised what I suppose Baldrick would call a cunning plan. So we gave the 2030 World Cup effectively to both of them. So there are three games at the start in Argentina, Uruguay and Paraguay, and all the rest will be played in Europe and Africa, in Spain, Portugal and Morocco. So suddenly, out of nowhere, you've got three continents who've had the World Cup since Asia last had the World Cup, plus the 2026 World Cup in the US, Canada and Mexico. So since Qatar, everyone's had a turn.
Yeah.
Except Asia again or Australasia.
Yeah.
But to make sure that Australia, who did want to bid, couldn't bid, he gave them a month to put up a full bid, by which, obviously, the Saudis have been tipped off way in advance. They've actually prepared their bid, all the details, all the venues, everything, before the month deadline was set. Within a few weeks, it was pretty obvious to the Australians they had no chance. And so from October of 23, it was a fait accompli that the World Cup in 2034 would be held in Saudi Arabia. They were the only bidders from Asia. They were the only bidders for the tournament. That was just confirmed and ratified by this acclamatory congress, where basically every nation's FA around the world dialed in on a Zoom call and weren't even allowed to vote. They just had to basically put their thumbs in the air and say yay. And lo and behold, they did.
You know, Martin, we spend a lot of time talking on this programme and others about geopolitical landscapes and political manoeuvring. But I got to say, this turn by FIFA has to be one of the most politically adept, astute, conniving pieces of choreography I have seen in quite some time. But you know, a number of years ago, there was a massive discussion about FIFA, inside of FIFA, the ticketing around FIFA, and it faced a lot of scrutiny over its decision-making process and how it awarded the previous World Cup to Qatar and all of that. But what does this decision reflect to you about FIFA and how it operates from within? And indeed, you know, how the world kind of allows them to do that and be manipulated by them?
Well, it's a fiefdom that's run by money, but that's not to say that in any way is it corrupt. Mm. There isn't, in the, you know, let's be honest, the 2018 World Cup was a scandalous decision and Russia bought it, and the 2022 World Cup was bought by Qatar. But they only had to buy a very small number of people, of individuals, because there was this small thing called the Executive Committee of 24 people, needed a majority of those, 12 people effectively, plus the casting vote of the president at the time, Sepp Blatter. Now, that was all changed when that regime at FIFA was thrown out the building in the wake of the 2015 FBI raid on the Bar-O-Lac Hotel at the FIFA Congress. New broom came in. You know, here's the new president, looks very much like the old president in some ways. He uses his power, Infantino. He uses the fact that FIFA can bestow millions onto each association for legitimate footballing expenses, for building stadiums and coaching centres and paying for coaching and kids and young girls and all of these things. Money they wouldn't otherwise get unless they went along with it. But of course, someone's got to provide the money. And in this case, that a lot of that money is being supplied by Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Now, we know that the PIF, the Public Investment Fund, has got a finger in a lot of sporting pies. Now we've seen it with LIV Golf. We've got Grand Prix there. We've got all the boxing there. It's a sporting epicenter now, no question. They wanted a World Cup. And to help secure the deal, you know, there's a Club World Cup coming up in the summer in the US. FIFA didn't have an obvious broadcast partner. Lo and behold, up comes DAZN, which is obviously officially a sort of British-Canadian company owned by Len Blavatnik, but he hasn't got the billions of pounds needed to pay for this. So it's an expectation or belief fueled worldwide that basically the Saudis are going to buy DAZN and funnel the money from Saudi to FIFA via DAZN. Legitimate, nothing wrong with it. It's not illegal. It's not dodgy. It's just a way of getting around the system. And FIFA needs the money because of the promises it's made to all the associations to give them huge sums of money and also the clubs to play in this Club World Cup so that the big clubs like Real Madrid and Chelsea and Manchester City are going to send their first team. They want a guarantee of 50 plus million pounds, understandably. So it's all a question of greasing the wheels, really.
Yeah. And look, you mentioned that investment fund and Mohammed bin Salman and their project 2030 is all about, broadening out and widening their sports catchment and all of that. Like, but when you look at football in particular, I suppose they own a lot of the Premiership clubs. I think they own clubs in France as well, maybe not Germany so much. But when you look at those kind of countries who've traditionally been the power brokers in European football or even world football to some extent, do you think that they're losing the grip on that and that it's just increasingly, because of the money, just ever more slightly seeping and slipping toward the Middle East in terms of its control?
Well, look, we have sovereign wealth funds owning a number of clubs and having stakes in others. You know, PSG are owned by the state of Qatar. Newcastle are a Saudi-owned club. There's Saudi investment in Chelsea via certain other avenues. Manchester City is Abu Dhabi. It is a way forward, unquestionably. A soft power is what we're looking at here. It's a way of broadening the reach. You know, Manchester City are the sort of global arm of the Abu Dhabi royal family in many ways, and are incredibly successful. There's no doubt about it. That has also paid for huge infrastructure projects in Manchester. Now, that Sports City complex is incredible, and it's a huge community asset for that side of Manchester. You know, so sometimes it's easy just to besmirch people for their intentions without actually seeing what they've done. At the same time, it has changed the face of football. The fact that Manchester City have been able to dominate English football tells you everything. If you said 10 years ago there's a Manchester club that's going to win 6 out of 7, people wouldn't have been surprised. They'd have just assumed they wore red rather than sky blue.
Well, I did actually want to ask you about Manchester City a little bit and what's happening with them in the courts at the moment, but I'm afraid time has come upon us yet again. But Martin, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. That was Martin Lipton, Chief Sports Reporter at The Sun. Thank you. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, Justin Trudeau joins a long list of young global leaders who have called it a day. We look at his legacy and Canada's precarious place in the new world as Donald Trump prepares to take the helm again at the White House.
Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
After this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, Justin Trudeau's decision to resign as Canadian Prime Minister may have surprised people outside of the Maple Leaf State, but there was a sense of what took you so long from Canadians' own political class. His 10-year reign, which promised so much, ended in acrimony with high prices and a view of Trudeau as the king of woke. Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Marika Walsh, who's the senior political reporter from The Globe and Mail in Ottawa. Marika, thank you very much for being with us today on Taking Stock.
It's my pleasure.
Now, he's such an interesting character, and we've been talking about him on Irish radio here all week. But maybe, Marika, you'd just take us back a little bit further into the Trudeau's family lineage, because, of course, his father was a prime minister, former prime minister of Canada. So just how important have the Trudeau family been in the political landscape in Canada?
They are absolutely a huge part of the political landscape of Canada, especially Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. He repatriated the Constitution, brought in the Charter of Rights. And it's really the start of Justin Trudeau's own political story, because he was quite literally born into office in a way. He was born on Christmas Day when his dad was already prime minister. So he was born into the prime minister's residence. He was born into the pomp and circumstance of that elite life in Canada. And while he was not taken seriously when he first came into the political stage in his own political career, that very quickly changed given his early successes.
And when he came in, what did he inherit in terms of the political party? Where were they at when he did come into power himself?
He took over the Liberal Party when it was at a historic low. It had been sort of steadily decimated and taken apart in a series of elections in which the Conservative Party won two minority governments and then in a majority government. And people had really begun to write off the Liberal Party, sort of begun to write its obituaries. And he won the leadership at this moment where people had very few expectations for the Liberal Party and, frankly, few expectations for what he could really do with it. The Conservatives at the time had written him off essentially as somebody with more hair than intelligence.
Yeah, terrible.
And they really underestimated him and set the bar low for him in a way that he was able to catapult over and capture the Canadian attention. There's so many fascinating parallels between how he came to office and how he's leaving, because he was the perfect foil to the Conservative Prime Minister at the time. And now he faced a Conservative leadership opponent who is the perfect foil to him.
He's almost like one of those politicians who has the perfect arc. He starts off, he picks up the party from a very low base. He reaches, you know, heights that people did not expect of him. And he doesn't leave before he's, you know, it's not a fait accompli. And actually, that really is my question. Like, we were a little bit shocked over here that he was leaving. But like, did he exit on his own terms, or was it actually a fait accompli?
No, he did not leave on his own terms. And you could even tell from his resignation, very brief resignation speech, just how much he wasn't leaving on his own terms. He was saying, I'm a fighter. I could still do this, but nobody is behind me. He was essentially blaming his party and his caucus revolt for his exit, rather than really taking stock of his own role in this. And what I mean by that is he did come to power on a really big wave of optimism and hope and goodwill towards him. He had about a 60% approval rating as a prime minister when he started in 2015, 2016. But the shine comes off, as it does with every leader. As you see, you know, there's some stories that politics, you know, transcends borders, and we see it in Ireland, we see it in Europe, in the UK. You know, the inflation crisis, the pandemic, all these things have wear and tear on leaders. Add to that, the prime minister had his own ethical scandals and his own lapses in judgment that really sort of took the shine off of what he presented to Canadians at the beginning, to the point where, you know, his caucus revolted on him in the last 6 months. But it was only because they were reading the tea leaves of Canadians and saw that they were all heading to a historic defeat, possibly worse than the defeat the party faced when Trudeau became leader, if he stayed on.
And before, I'm going to get to why he's leaving and all that, and the Trump stuff and their place in the world in a second, but I'm very interested in just seeing what, if anything, he did right, you know, when the history books are written and they look back and all this sort of, you know, in the minuteness ends. He must have done some things well to have, you know, climbed up that greasy pole and actually, you know, been very popular at one point.
For sure. And I think absolutely he did. You know, he made reforms to government benefits and subsidies that lifted kids and families with kids out of poverty. That is a material change you can see in statistics, for example. He really put a lot of political capital into crafting a climate change plan, but he did it in such a polarizing way, in a way that was a my way or the highway, if you're not with us, you're wrong kind of approach, that really turned people off. And that really, especially in a country as huge as Canada, where different resource sectors thrive and flourish in different parts of the country and they have different political colors at the same time, it was really divisive at the same time. And so he absolutely has things to point to. The renegotiation of the free trade deal under the Donald Trump first administration was seen as a huge win, was seen as Canada really being able to navigate this unpredictable, uncertain moment and coming out largely unscathed from it, despite the, you know, despite how much oxygen it took up, despite how much attention it took from domestic agendas of politicians. He still was able to manage it and was able to get the country through it in a really remarkable way. And interestingly, when you look next, you know, the next huge disruption that Canada and everybody else in the world faced was the pandemic. And he again had quite, he had quite sort of positive reviews, especially in the early response of the pandemic. And his Liberal Party's numbers became quite buoyant in the public opinion polling in that context. But then ever since he called the snap election in 2021 to make use of that, those buoyant numbers for his own political gain, those numbers have never recovered. He never was able to recapture that mood.
Yeah, and I think that is such an interesting dynamic in his premiership, because a little bit like Macron in France, you know, trying to gamble on that positive management, well, not in Macron's case, the management of the pandemic, but in Trudeau's case, the management of the pandemic. Let's look at his place on the world stage, and maybe a lot of the speculation about why he's leaving now is to do with Trump coming in. But there are other aspects to his placement of Canada in a geopolitical sense, the relationship with China, the NATO alliances. Maybe talk us through how you think he's performed on the global stage in a wider sense.
It's so fascinating because Trudeau mania, which is what people called the sort of the captive audience that his father had, also came to Justin Trudeau as Trudeau mania 2.0 in 2015. And it wasn't just in Canada. It was around the world. He was being mobbed by crowds in Asia when he was on international trips. Him and his wife were on the front page of Vogue as this sort of darling couple of the progressive left that was sort of taking on the mantle from Obama's, and sort of that sort of very glossy image just didn't hold up on the world stage. And what I mean by that is that he, for example, came to power telling the world, "We're back," a very confident message to project. But very quickly, he, for example, failed in his bid to get a seat on the UN Security Council. Mm. You know, he never brought Canada's defense spending up to the NATO targets. And that is really something that we are now seen as a laggard on, especially given the war in Ukraine, especially given the response in Europe to bolster defense spending, that we have been slow to get on that. And then on top of that, there is what was really viewed as a naive approach to China at the beginning, where he was pursuing a free trade deal with China. And then all of that changed in a dramatic fashion with the arrest of what we call the two Michaels, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, in retaliation for Canada's arrest of Meng Wanzhou, who was a chief executive at Huawei, the Chinese state-owned company. So there was just sort of one thing after the other on the world stage that he was viewed as sort of struggling to anticipate or to manage, and that was viewed as sort of a struggle to have actions meet the rhetoric that he spoke of, and that was an issue he had domestically and internationally, where he had such soaring rhetoric and soaring promises that just became very challenging for him to execute on.
Mm. And that the aspect of Donald Trump coming back in again now, and a lot of speculation about how Trudeau, you know, under a lot of pressure internally, but you've had those discussions about Donald Trump using this opportunity to call again for Canada to become the American 51st state, and all of that pressure about US trade and tariffs. Maybe you just give us all a little flavour of what the economic relationship between Canada and the US is, because that trade deficit that they have with Canada is a very important one, obviously a lot to do with energy and natural resources. Maybe talk us through that economic relationship, because I don't think we fully understand the connectedness here.
Yeah, the U.S. is Canada's most important trading partner by a mile, and we sell heavily into that market. It makes sense we do. We're a very small country population-wise compared to the U.S. We have about 40 million people. They have more than 300 million. But that leads to what Donald Trump fixates on as these trade deficits, but it's really just the U.S. consumes more than we do. So we ship a lot of our crude oil energy to the U.S. for refining. We have a very integrated auto manufacturing market where the auto parts go back and forth across the border as a car is assembled. It's not like a car is assembled in Detroit and then sold. It's that it goes back and forth across the border between Ontario and Detroit, and then eventually becomes a car. And so it's an incredibly integrated market. It's one that Canada absolutely relies on because America is the elephant. They are the big dominant economy in North America, and Mexico and Canada have this integrated relationship with them. What's so interesting this time around is how different the context in Canada and the US is. So when Donald Trump was first elected in 2016, Justin Trudeau was on a high. Mm. He had the political capital. He had a majority government. He was still a fresh face. And so the context in which he was challenging Donald Trump and defending Canada is very different from now, where he is essentially a lame duck prime minister, and he was essentially a lame duck prime minister before he even announced his resignation, because everybody could see the tea leaves. Everybody could see that he didn't have the political power needed to rally Canada in the same way, to construct this Team Canada approach where all the other premiers of all the provinces would fall in line behind his strategy. And so what was once seen as sort of a political winner for Justin Trudeau as challenging Donald Trump has now become one of his weak points, in that he doesn't have that political capital needed to really credibly challenge Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, just like Canadians, can read the same polls, see the same political dynamics, and know that Justin Trudeau, even before he announced his resignation, was a leader on his way out, not a leader he would really have to be dealing with.
Marika, I have two final questions for you. One is, in Ireland here, there's a lot of fear around the place about Donald Trump coming in. We're heavily dependent on American multinationals, not just in the tech sector, but the pharma sector, amongst others. So we're kind of looking at all different sort of ways at how we might safeguard against this with soft diplomacy and stuff like that. The first question is, do Canadians have that sense of fear now? And my final question is, what do you think the legacy of Justin Trudeau will actually be when time passes on and we get out of this period?
On the first part about the U.S. Challenge, absolutely. I think we almost probably feel it the most pronounced because Donald Trump has promised to levy 25% tariffs on all Canadian imports into the U.S. when he becomes president. That is a promise that, if acted on, would immediately launch Canada into a recession in a very profound way, lead to significant job losses. It would have a devastating impact. What is missed by Americans and Donald Trump is the impact it would have on the U.S. as well, because it would raise prices for them. It would have economic impacts on them because of how integrated we are. But people really believe this time Donald Trump means it when he says it. And we have increasingly become more serious in a sense, you know, the jokes, or what was written off as jokes about the 51st state becoming Canada, part of the U.S., is now taken so seriously that Donald Trump might have actually made a mistake this week when he talked about sort of taking Canada by economic force, because it has actually united Canadians in a way that he might not have anticipated. He might have actually taken the joke too far, in a sense that it has actually sharpened people's focus and sharpened the attention to people. The optimists will say Canada made it through tariffs, made it through trade negotiations and battles before with Donald Trump, and we can do it again. And we just have to sort of be patient and see. But I think that there is this sense of trying to figure out what Donald Trump means based on what he's saying and what is actually real. And I think that is still playing out. So I think that is something that's still to be determined. But certainly the world, I think, is looking very carefully and cautiously and being very careful in its responses to Trump, not just in Canada, but in Ireland and in Europe and in NATO as well.
And finally, just time is upon us now, but just very quickly, your sense of what Trudeau's legacy will be?
I think it will, you know, it's very hard to tell in 30 years what people will say about somebody in this moment, right? Because the emotional anger and turnoff that Trudeau has created in Canada is very pronounced. People are just truly over him. And so it is hard to see. The comparison, I think, right now is to Joe Biden, where somebody who had the potential to leave on such a high if they chose to take their exit early, instead waited too long and now risks their entire political agenda being undone by their successor.
Yeah.
So I think it's to be determined, but certainly part of the Justin Trudeau story will be that he did not take his cues on when to leave. The other part will be that he made huge social reforms, that he did lead Canada through crises, and precisely how all these things play out in 30 years will depend on what happens to our major spending and deficits that he also leaves, what happens to our debts, what happens on the climate file. So I just think it's too early to say really where it will go.
Well, as with many things in life, timing is everything, and we've run out of it. But Marika Walsh, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And it's fascinating insight to what lies behind one of the stories of the week. That was Marika Walsh, senior political reporter with The Globe and The Mail in Ottawa. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, the programme for government talks are well underway, and two men who've been involved in or on the margins of these type of talks are going to be with us next to tell us all about the type of skullduggery that goes on behind the scenes. Stay tuned as former Labour Party leader Pat Rabbit and journalist and author Stephen Collins join us after this short.
At Capella University, learning the right skills could make a difference. That's why our business programs teach you relevant skills you can take from the courseroom to the workplace. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
Break. You welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, as the dust settles on November's general election, all eyes turn to the matchmaking process between Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and most likely the regional independents in the race to form a new government. But just how does that process work? Who calls who? How is the programme for government formed? And what are the competing interests in this particular arrangement? Well, joining me now to discuss are two men who've got quite some experience in this realm, former Labour Party leader Pat Rabbit and Stephen Collins, columnist, author and former political editor of the Irish Times. Join me now in studio. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome and thank you both for coming on for this very cold winter's day. Pat, I'm going to start with you. Maybe you just, before we get into the mechanics of all this, what coalition governments have you been involved in discussions behind the scenes on?
I was a member of the negotiating team in 94 and again in 2011. And I suppose the first thing that one should dismiss is commentary that one hears occasionally about who'll be Taoiseach and for how long and who'll be in the cabinet. Those questions don't feature in the negotiations. They're matters for the leaders of the parties. And the leaders of the parties settle those questions and then they may or may not tell their negotiating team, or they may or may not tell their negotiating team the full story. But they're in charge of who will be the next EU commissioner, who will be Taoiseach first.
They make the big calls, really.
They do.
But actually, that's one of the questions I want to ask you at the outset. Those first days, just in the wake of a general election, that type of spinning that goes on, how important is that in the overall process? Or does it matter at the end of the day?
Not very. It's politicking. It's a continuation of a version of the general election campaign. When people take off their jackets in the Sycamore Room or wherever in government buildings, a lot of that goes out the window. You have to then settle on a political programme that, insofar as it can, is representative of the balance of the parties striving to make up the government, and at the same time not setting yourself targets that you're manifestly going to fail to meet. So it gets serious at that stage, and a lot of the rest is fraught, and the actual negotiators don't pay too much attention. I mean, this habit that has grown up in recent times since the fragmentation of politics following the financial collapse, you know, involves all kinds of parties and individuals that would run a mile. They would head for the hills at the first squall. There wouldn't be any question of that. But they have a chance of getting 40 seconds on the evening news.
Yeah.
And that's all it's about. But they never are serious about serving in government.
Bit of theatrics that goes on around the margins of it, for sure. Stephen, just on the technicalities of this, Pat has mentioned the fragmentation of politics in Ireland here. But you know, talk me through that, what happens constitutionally. It's the Dáil, of course, who elect the government. But when you're in a situation where it's very clear that there's no one party who's going to have the ability to elect a Taoiseach and a government, what are the constitutional arrangements? What are the processes that sit underneath that to actually help them to actually form a government now?
Well, things really changed in 1989 when Fianna Fáil failed to get an overall majority and Charlie Haughey, after a lot of manoeuvring, decided the only way he'd get back into power was to do a coalition deal with the PDs. So when the Dáil met to elect the Taoiseach after the election, he wasn't elected Taoiseach. It was the first time in the history of the state previously a new Taoiseach was elected, and they worked out the programme afterwards. Now, they didn't work these elaborate programmes they're doing now. They agreed a few points and they sat down. But 1989, Charlie Haughey was not elected Taoiseach, and there was a big rumpus in the Dáil. His advice from the Attorney General was that he continues as Taoiseach until he's replaced. Dick Spring made a huge drama out of the fact that he'd lost the confidence of the House, he should resign. Alan Dukes went along with the Haughey's version of things, and actually he ended up losing the leadership of Fine Gael in the end because of that. So Charlie went up and resigned reluctantly. He came back and then he went about negotiating with the PDs. But in fact, lawyers I've spoken to since say that Haughey's interpretation was right. A Taoiseach is a Taoiseach until he's replaced. So you can call him the acting Taoiseach, but there's no such constitutional position. Mm. The Dáil selects a Taoiseach, and until the Dáil selects a new Taoiseach, the outgoing Taoiseach is the Taoiseach. So in the current situation, Simon Harris remains the Taoiseach until the Dáil decides who the next Taoiseach is going to be.
Yeah, and that's what's ongoing at the moment, the discussions in the background about who will ultimately be that and whether or not they can do that on the 22nd of January, which they all seem determined to do. But Pat, let's look at your situation. You mentioned that you were involved in 1994, and I think that that was a particularly unique one because that's interim government, if you like. So one government collapsed, and then how does that work when you're going into that situation with somebody already in government? Is that the right configuration? Have I got it right there?
Well, the Fianna Fáil Labour government came apart after about 21 months or 22 months. But there had been, immediately before the bust-up, there had been a number of by-elections. I remember driving from Cork. There were two by-elections in Cork which elected Hugh Coveney and Kathleen Lynch. And hearing on the news that Dick Spring withdrew his ministers from a cabinet meeting that was to appoint the president of the High Court. And instinctively, I knew that's it. So we're heading into a general election or else. The by-elections, however, gave sufficient votes to Fine Gael Labour and the Democratic Left to form a majority. John Bruton had resisted participation in government by Democratic Left 2 years earlier. This time around, he changed his view, and the party sat down to hammer out a platform, and that was agreed.
And that was the Rainbow Coalition.
And that was the Rainbow Coalition.
And when you're sitting there and you know that that's going to happen, you're getting involved in it, like, do you sit down as a party and say, look, here's our red lines initially? Do you go in with a bigger document and start to negotiate? What happens there?
Not really. You don't go in with any padding or as little padding other than as a bargaining ruse. You know, you go in on the things that have been thrown up in the general election and that are important. And the things that are bargainable, where there's a middle ground arithmetically speaking or whatever, that can be hammered out. There are other issues that are not open to that kind of... I mean, for example, now I've just heard again about the new rate of VAT being advocated by Fine Gael in the present situation. Well, of course, it can't be a new rate in the sense that there can only be...
A reduction
two,
as
yeah,
such,
there
yeah.
There can only be two rates because of European Union. Well, if you count zero, there can be three. But if you raise the 9% to 11% or whatever it is, well, either you do that or you don't do that. You can't say, we'll settle for 10.
Yes, yeah.
You know,
there's no compromise position here.
You know, there are issues that present... And, you know, you either have to agree them or you don't. And you start to make progress and you sign off on, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, but you sign off on what's easily done. And then you come back to the stumbling blocks and see, well, all right, in this particular case, you can have that.
Yes.
But we want this.
And it's bartering one against the other. Stephen, so if we kind of look at this in pillars, you've got the government, who gets what ministries, who's the Taoiseach, who's the Taoiseach, for what period of time. And then the other thing that's become quite significant in recent years, we talk more and more about it, is this programme for government. And the PDs kind of changed the game and the programme for government sequencing, because there was a period where you negotiated the government and you were in government and then you worked out the programme for government. Mm. But now it's kind of, is it all happening in tandem? Is one dependent on the other?
Well, I think the way Pat's put it, and he's right, the leaders will settle the big issues in personnel terms. Who's Taoiseach? How many cabinet seats are we going to have and how many cabinet seats are you going to have? And do we give the independents a cabinet seat or junior ministries or whatever? But the actual detailed programme, I think it's both the politicians and the party officials that they work out this detailed long programme for government.
And was that always the case? Like, was it always that the programme for government had to be simultaneous with the government? Like, I just...
No, it wasn't. I think my memory of the past is, for instance, when back in 1973, and I wasn't in covering politics then.
I thought you were going to say you weren't even born.
I was well born. I actually, in 1973, I counted votes.
Okay.
Which gave me an understanding of PR, which I never would have got if I was a student at the time. It was very easy and handy money and very informative. But in 73, Labour and Fine Gael had fought the election on the basis of a 14-point programme. They were going to go into government together. The programme was already agreed. And actually, Brendan Halligan, who was the Labour General Secretary, tells the story of how they had to fire up Brendan Corish, who was the Labour leader, to say, we want five cabinet positions, whereas they were entitled to four on numbers. Corish went into the room, slightly reluctantly was going to raise this with Cosgrave, and Cosgrave looked at him and said, Brendan, would five cabinet positions be okay? So that settled that, and that set the tone for that government. The two guys got on extremely well from then on. But I think it was only when the PDs negotiated with Haughey, and again it came down to personnel at the end of the day, and it came down to how many cabinet positions were they going to have. And the PDs, I remember Des O'Malley's wife telling me that Bobby Molloy was a real negotiator. Mm. That an earlier, during some of the heaves, the other people were advising Desi and they backed off at the last moment. Des was prepared to possibly accept maybe one cabinet position for himself, but Bobby Molloy wanted to be in the cabinet, and he said he downfaced Charlie. I said, looked at Charlie and said, I'm prepared to jump out the window, are you? And others have an election. Mm. Charlie said, okay, Kipini's got two cabinet positions.
Yeah.
And they got this detailed programme, which then had to be renegotiated after 2 years.
Yeah.
So programmes for government have become much more significant since. And there is a question, I think, though, whether they are too detailed. After the financial collapse, was it the Nyberg report? We had these big reports into what happened. And one of them said, one of the problems with Irish governments is they're ticking the boxes on the programme for government when the economic position has changed and it's time to
jettison. Before you go into that, Stephen, I remember a small little bit of history on that 1973 when I was president of the Union of Students in Ireland at the time. And I remember myself and two or three more going to the HQ of the Labour Party with whatever mischievous proposals we had to cause poor, nice Jack Lynch problems at that time. And we knocked on the door in Earlsford Terrace at the time, and so on. And the door was open, but nobody answered or whatever. And we kept proceeding in, and we found in a back room Garrett Fitzgerald and Brendan Halligan refining the 14 points, which, you know, was incredible. It suggested to me that Garrett was as centrally involved as the Labour Party in the 14 proposals.
And I think you're right, Stephen, something you said there, maybe they've become too detailed in recent years, and some of the things I've been hearing around the margins of this one is that they're going to be a little bit less prescriptive than they were in 2020. And maybe that has a lot to do with the Greens wanting to get their stuff, you know, into the programme of government to be sure that it was acted upon. One of the things I want to explore with you, Pat, if I can, is the current day situation and what's happening. And I'm particularly interested in the regional independence because, look, when we're talking about years gone by, this particular one seems very civilised, doesn't it, between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. We've got that parity of esteem going anyway. The sentiment was positive from the get-go. There was no sort of, you know, triumphalism, I think, by Micheál Martin or anything like that. So that's going along, ticking along. But the question for me is about the regional independence. What are they at now, right? So they're a grouping, but they're not organised in the way that the political parties would be. So they don't have a team of people who are, you know, working in government departments for them. How do you think that they have managed things so far? And in particular about Michael Lowry, I'm just wondering about him as their lead negotiator. Does his, you know, the presence of him in the media now, and there's questions about him, does that kind of weaken their position in any way?
Well, it's an Irish innovation. You know, independence for me meant something growing up in politics. Sean Dublin Bailoff to Sir Jim Kemmy or
whatever it was. But now apparently we have at least one party for independence, which I would have thought was an oxymoron. And then separately we put together this group of regional deputies that you talk about. It probably is no more, Mandy, I think, than a small number of independent deputies saying that they would like to be in government. Mm. The likes of Sean Kenny and Boxer Morn were there before, and I think they got a liking for it and want to go back. And, you know, this group was hastily convened. I mean, I heard Marion Harkin on radio explaining why she lost her seat. She thought it was all over. She was a number of thousands of votes behind.
Incredible, yeah. Really, isn't
now,
it?
Now, yeah. She's apparently in this group. Mm. So that I think it's been driven by that. And the person who has the experience and has been there before is Michael Lowry. And they seem to have chosen him as their coordinator and as the person who knows his way around the labyrinthine.
And what do you think they should be aiming for in terms of departments? You know, they're asking about a super junior. Like, what should be the level of their ambition, or where do you think?
Well, if I were the two leaders, I wouldn't concede a senior cabinet position. I think, you know, that if the two leaders had been stern at the beginning, that they would jump at a couple of junior ministries and a couple of chairs of committees. Mm. But they seem to have allowed create the space where they are willing to concede a cabinet minister. Now, I suppose Micheál Martin and Simon Harris will say, well, listen, we're interested in building something with a solid foundation that will stay the course. And the best way to do that is to put one of them in the cabinet. So will there be conflict about who it is? Sean Kenny thinks it will be him. Is that agreed in advance? We don't know.
We don't know.
Well, I was just into Leinster House and picking up gossip from people who are not involved at all, I hasten to add, in the negotiations.
And there's a lot of those around.
A lot of people around. But I'm not sure they will get a cabinet position. Michael Lowry put the group together. Michael Lowry doesn't want to be in the cabinet and certainly couldn't be in the cabinet. But I think Lowry has incredible experience. That the Rainbow government Pat is talking to about, I remember talking to a member of that government who said it wouldn't have happened without Michael Lowry. Lowry was the one who actually put it all together, told John Bruton to go home, stay quiet, and he'd be Taoiseach, and Lowry did the talk to the people. So he's very, when it comes to the nuts and bolts of politics, he really understands it. He's also utterly reliable in political terms. If Lowry does a deal, the deal sticks.
Yeah.
And I think that is why the others have focused on him. Last time round it was Shane Ross. And I think the independents would have more confidence in Michael Lowry to kind of do a kind of a deal that would suit them. Again, you also have the issue, ideologically, there is no problem with them. The independents, I think, have this in common. They wanted to get the Greens out of government. They represent rural constituencies mainly, and they will be pushing an agenda which will be close to the hearts of most Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
I think that's
TDs.
A very important point.
So there isn't, and I think also with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I think unlike previous negotiations when there were ideological differences, even Pat could explain the rainbow, you had Fine Gael and you had Labour and the Workers' Party, of which Pat was a member, and Fine Gael wouldn't talk to them in 92, but did in 94, and actually they got on very well in government. But this time round, there are no huge ideological differences.
No.
Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, people say that they're working hard, they're working till midnight last night, hammering out this programme for government. But they've been in government together for the last 5 years. They were in conference and supply for the previous 4 or 5 years. So there's no huge ideological
difference. No, I think that's a very important point. The days when an independent would be prepared to risk all to bring down a government like Jim Kemmy did, or Joe Sherlock did, or Sean Dublin Bay Loftus, that day is gone. Mm. The modern-day independent is interested in longevity, no matter what they say. They're interested in longevity. And we're now in a situation where if you look at the three big issues, it seems to me, housing, climate action and immigration. They're the three big issues. And as Stephen says, Fianna Fáil in particular, Fine Gael less so, will feign to be horrified at the demands that will be coming from the regional group about issues like immigration and climate action in particular. But they will be delighted and will be dragged along with it and say, sure, we had no alternative. The House of Cards would come down if we didn't agree.
I've heard that. I've heard that before. Pat Rabbit, Stephen Collins, listen, thank you both very much for coming in to me today. We could spend the entire hour of the programme. Did you want to say something else?
One more thing was, I expected that this would all be sorted by the 22nd of January. What I'm told today is no, it won't be. That there are, Fine Gael, would you believe it, have to have four regional meetings of members to approve any programme for government, and then the parliamentary party have to approve. Fianna Fáil have a similar thing of, I think, one...
Yeah, I think the process is after the initial agreement. Now so factored
think,
in,
I think
maybe another
probably,
week.
They'll agree their programme probably by the 22nd, but the rest, it'll take a week or so to get it all ratified. So
sure, Elon Musk will be running us by then.
Absolutely.
We won't need a government.
Yes, exactly. I think the process has taken over far more than it should. It shouldn't have gone on this long at all, but it's going to.
Well, look, gentlemen, we might have you back if you're willing to do so once it is all formed. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to Pat Rabbit, former Labour Party leader, and Stephen Collins, columnist and former political editor for the Irish Times. Thank you both. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks, as always, to all of today's guests for their time and very valuable insights. The series producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. Stephen Daunt was on research and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's items, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is up next with all your new Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.